This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network in Italian Studies. I'm your host, Kate Driscoll, Assistant Professor of Italian and Romance Studies at Duke University. It's my delight to be joined today by my dear colleague and friend, Professor Eugenio Ruffini, Chair of Italian Studies at New York University. There are many words with which one could introduce you, Eugenio, but allow me to start with your exceptional research. Eugenio Ruffini is a specialist of questions of reception, translation, and forms of adaptation, explored through the intersections of rhetoric, poetics, drama, music, and voice studies. His first monograph, Per via denotazioni, published in 2009, looks at the Renaissance reception of Horace's Art of Poetry as a seminal moment in the making of early modern literary theory. His second book, The Vernacular Aristotle, Translation as Reception in Medieval and Renaissance Italy, published with Cambridge University Press in 2020, discusses the vernacular appropriation of Aristotle as a lens through which to reassess the place of translation within any process of reception. Similar questions inform his many publications on the reception of the sublime in rhetoric, poetics, and music. His third monograph, and the subject of our conversation today, is titled Staging the Soul, Allegorical Drama as Spiritual Practice in Baroque Italy, published by Legenda with the University of Oxford and the Modern Humanities Research Association in 2023. This book, as we will soon discuss, explores pedagogical uses of dramatic allegories in Italy around the year 1600, with a focus on the place of theater in the education of female orphans in the hospitals of Venice. Eugenio, welcome. I'm so happy to have you for this conversation today. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Kate. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be part of this series and a delight to be talking about my book with you.
Lovely. So we should just jump right in. And I think we all want to know what the story is of how did we receive the book that we have printed hard copy in our hands today? How did the idea for the volume emerge, and when did it reach you? How did it reach you in your research trajectory?
Oh, thank you. This is a very good question because it allows me to go a little bit down memory lane. The origin of this book really goes back to my doctoral dissertation, which I defended in Pisa, the Scuola Normale Superiore, back in 2010. What happened there is that I was writing a dissertation on questions of allegorical drama in Italy around 1600. And of course, as is often the case with doctoral dissertation works, I had plenty of ideas. I wasn't able to follow all the threads which I was hoping to follow at the time. So the dissertation per se was completed. Then in my life, something happened in the sense that I started a postdoctoral fellowship in the UK, working on a rather different topic, which brought me to the Aristotle book, which you kindly mentioned earlier. And so I left my dissertation work there, sort of on hold for a while. Of course, during the years, I did continue to think about it. I did continue to do some side research on the topic. And during the pandemic, when I was, you know, as we all were, sort of stuck at home without really a chance to do new research, I thought it would be a good moment to go back to my folders on allegorical drama around 1600 and see whether I was really sort of ready for bringing that project to completion in terms of transforming that original text into dissertation. So the final result is very different from the dissertation, and there are several chunks of the book which weren't part of the dissertation, particularly the detailed analysis of the plays. We might go back to that later, which occupies the final chapter of the book. So it's been a long story. Really, I think the moment when I decided it was time to go back to it beyond the circumstances of COVID was some new findings I had a chance to make really almost by accident when I was in Venice at the Biblioteca Marciana doing research on a different project. So, you know, that's how our job tends to develop, right? Quite often in unexpected ways. And this was, I think, around 2018, 2019. So I was still working on my previous book, and yet I was kind of finding ways to, you know, make the most of other research endeavors as well. And so I slowly got back into the Staging the Soul project.
That's wonderful. I love that the story of the all the different routes that brought you back to the work, and then how it becomes renewed again over time. I feel like that fits in so well with what you pursue in the book about the use of this literature as it occasions different types of reading at different periods. So that question, or your answer to that question, brings me to ask you to just explain a little bit then how these kind of key terms that evolve in the book between allegory, image making, and personification, and the kinds of traditions and currents that follow them and that give these meaning shape over time. Like, how was it that this became the corpus to rely on as the book was developing? Could you share how it came to pass that these were the terms that started to take kind of center stage in the book, and where you saw the potential to draw out a performative reading of them that brings us to think about allegory, image making, personifications in new ways from how they had been read?
Right. Well, this is another excellent question. Thank you, Kate. Well, I mean, I think that the main point, again, is thinking about the original core of the question I was asking. It all began with my interest in thinking about the rhetorical figure of the personification, or prosopopoeia, as an interesting literary device where writing, so words, get together inevitably with images. And, you know, personification is the idea of giving a body and a voice, possibly, to something which is abstract, right? This was the original, really, question I was interested in. And the following step was to imagine a situation where these personifications get to be characters in dramatic plays. So I thought I would try to take literally the personification device as a process through which an abstract entity or even a concept get to be given a body and a voice. And of course, the stage seems to be the ideal space for this kind of experiment. The initial idea of thinking about the history of the figure personification, combined with the idea of seeing what happened in the early modern period when these personifications got to be used in drama. And the further step was to finding out that actually, particularly in the context of spiritual drama, personifications were extremely abundant in the decades around 1600. The theoretical framework, the performative framework, if I can call it that way, really is the final step, if you will, in the sense that after several years working on this project, I eventually got to the point where I sort of thought, okay, I need to sort of wrap things up and bring all these bits and pieces together. And I really, again, tried to think about performance as the space where performative things happen. And I thought about taking literally even this notion, right? The idea that when something is given a body and a voice on stage, they are indeed performing in the double sense of, you know, performative when we think about linguistics and the sense of performative as related to performance. And so this has been the sort of sequence of steps which brought me from the initial idea to the framework of performance and performative, which eventually constitutes the frame of the work.
Right, right, exactly. And so much of that then really depends on these abstractions being presented on stage, but then being presented in dialogue with one another, as you call them, these dangerous co-protagonists who are up against man in trying to make sense of not only life, but especially death. And the next question I want to ask then is that how all of this develops in Baroque Italy. And I want us just to linger on the kind of qualifier of that, right? An Italy that is Baroque and a term that comes with a substantial degree of materials and things that are in archives that have been overlooked in part because of the connotations and the meetings, even baggage that Baroque has had to schlep around now for a little bit. And so when we think about the Baroque, we encounter this puzzle whereby it's difficult in the way that Baroque has been labeled, let's say, to see where morality would surface in a period that gets labeled for being excessive and a bad taste, that there's this general lack of gravitas and moral discipline. And yet you bring us to this rich repertoire of works in which these are the very questions that they're after. And so having worked, I know, in your research in the Baroque in sort of all of its different capacities, did you have an early interest in this period's pedagogies? Because that's again one of these dominant threads in the book is the interest in how do you make pedagogical sense of these texts in the way that they were originally designed or, you know, surfaced in different periods later on. And if you did have that early interest in the Baroque's pedagogies or pedagogical models, was this something that you felt you got to explore in new ways precisely because, as you just explained, you arrived at them with an interest really in that double use of performative and it's what the performative rhetorical linguistic possibilities when we look at text through that lens or the performative precisely because these were stage productions?
Wow. That is another fantastic set of things to think about. Thank you, Kate. The short answer is yes, in a way, in the sense that the pedagogical dimension of the literature I'm exploring in the book has always been there. Maybe not as a primary concern as of the beginning, but of course it was there. What wasn't there at the beginning was the Baroque focus. And that's maybe an interesting story to tell, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. Because, of course, the idea of including Baroque in the title of the book came at the end of the project, so to speak. And I didn't sort of take that decision lightly. And I'm not even 100% sure that I'm totally happy with it in a way, because of course I'm very interested in Baroque culture, and I think that there are so many interesting aspects of Baroque culture which need desperately to be reassessed. And this applies to the intersections of literature and the arts, literature and visual culture, literature and the performing arts, so on and so forth. But there's also a problem with the term. As you were saying, the term Baroque comes with a heavy baggage. You know, there are champions of the Baroque as well as people who have been always more dismissive. Now, my interest in using the term Baroque was really a way at the end of this process to try to highlight something peculiar about the kind of works I was exploring in this project. And particularly when it comes to the analysis of the plays, which I do in the second part of the book, I think that the label Baroque with all its problems and issues, even at the level of historiography, remains particularly productive because it captures the sort of irregular nature of these works, which are at the very same time extremely canonical, because these are, you know, five-act plays, more or less modeled according to the standards of classical theater, and yet within them we find all sorts of things which classical or classicist theater didn't want to have in a play. And the particular figure around whom I sort of build my narrative in the second part of the book, Fabio Glissenti, on whom we might say something more later, is really, I think, the embodiment of these various tensions at work in the early 17th century. And so in the end, I thought that even if Baroque comes with its issues, it was a good label to at least signpost the direction which these works were taking. And the pedagogical dimension of this story, to go back to the previous part of your question, was really crucial to allow me to frame the narrative, because all these works really are concerned with some sort of pedagogy, be it spiritual, be it individual, be it collective. And the dramatic context, the stage, or even the individual reading of a play, which is in principle meant to be staged, really become a space for pedagogical experiences which border spiritual experiences. And so that's the kind of further connection when we talk about pedagogy within this context.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
That's great. That's wonderfully helpful. And I think having mentioned Fabio Glissenti in that answer, it sets us up wonderfully to reveal more about this name, which will probably sound fairly new to, I imagine, most people who are interested in new books in Italian studies, and then even those of us who have PhDs in this field. And so, what's wonderful about someone about Glissenti, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, is that he seems so relevant to the way that our field is changing and making more space for this dialogue between medical, environmental, literary, and dramatic sides of the humanities. And so we have this physician of the body who emerges in your book as this great doctor of the soul, and giving different models of I don't know if we can call it self-care, but it's a great way to think about the dynamism of books that aren't destined for, let's say, one type of reader or one discipline, one kind of disciplinary approach to a book. And so if we can hear more about Glissenti and what you make of this opportunity that the Baroque gives us to have a physician who is also interested in describing for audiences and readers who might engage with text at the meditation and meditative level, a way to think about the art of dying well, and if that constitutes a form of self-care.
Yes, absolutely. Let me try to cover at least a few of these aspects. So Glissenti, to contextualize a little bit, is this physician, so a doctor based in Venice. He was born near Brescia, living really in Venice around 1600, and working for the local ospedali. So, you know, he was a professional in the field of medicine, trained as a natural philosopher in Padua, So he was really sort of, you know, ticking all the boxes of the natural philosopher kind of figure in those decades. But clearly also interested in the philosophical dimension of his work more broadly, which brought him to write a number of works, which then ended up being my main case study in the book. Now, the reason why I picked this particular case study is probably worth reviewing briefly, because of course this is not a major figure in the history of Italian literature, not even in scholarship. There's a very good monograph by George McClure on Glisenti, who really tackles the more sort of historical and socio-historical dimension of his work, but there's not much beyond that. So it's not a well-known figure. But I found his works, which were printed in Venice in the early 17th century, during the kind of, you know, review of bibliography, which every doctoral student has to do when working on their dissertation. And my very ambitious project, of course, at the beginning of my dissertation writing was to imagine a sort of, you know, I thought it about as an exhaustive sort of list of spiritual dramas around 1600 using allegorical personifications. And of course, the number of works was really too big to handle in a dissertation, and I really needed to narrow down my focus. And while doing research at the British Library in London, over, I think it was the summer of 2009, I ended up really bumping into the works of this guy, Fabio Glisenti. There were some 12 plays published between 1606 and 1612. And then I found out that he was also the author of a very substantial, massive book on the art of dying well, and Ars Moriendi, which was sort of complementary to the kind of work he did in the plays. So I sort of identified a kind of a cluster of works around the figure of this interesting doctor. And I thought, let's give it a try. Let's try to make sense of what's happening here. And so that's how I ended up really deciding to have this strong focus on him. And then, as I mentioned earlier, over the years, going back to Venice to do research on other things, I ended up finding materials in the Marciana, which I hadn't found before, including manuscript materials, which weren't part of the sort of previous scholarship on this topic, which really sort of helped me go back to Glisenti and give the entire narrative a tighter structure. But just to go back to your other point about the intricacy of these various threads, yes, the answer is yes, in terms of combining the medical dimension of what he did, the environmental dimension of what he did, because he has this very strong focus on combining the experience of the individual with the space surrounding them, and the body versus soul kind of dynamic. These various topics are part of his experiment as an author in ways which are not canonical. And that brings us back to the question of what is irregular about Baroque literature, particularly at this historical juncture.
That's great. And I think what was lovely to hear in that answer too is that there's so many mysteries that await us, whether they're in the Marciana in Venice or in the British Library, but in so many places, just because of the bibliographical tradition that has not always followed these figures. But how could we make Baroque figures less Baroque in a way? That kind of came to me as a thought. So because now we've entered Glisenti territory, and we could talk about, let's say, first his discorsi morali, his moral discourses, before we talk about the morality plays per se, I'm curious if we could hear the story of the book's cover image and this beautiful woodcut of a female figure contemplating death and in a solitary space. And as you just explained to us in your answer, space really gives so much definition to what Glisenti's textual goal is, and then how that goal gets translated via images kind of brings us back to what you were saying just a few minutes ago. And so when you were working in Venice, you were looking at this text and you were surprised by them. At what point did you know that that was the image that was going to speak to you in kind of a profound way? And then how did that become the image that you ended up selecting for the cover of the book?
Thank you, Kate. I mean, this is another very good point, because I would say that that image, which the sort of listeners can check out online if they look for the cover of the book, is a very important one to my own research. And I think fairly early in the process, I knew that that image would play an important role, even before thinking really about the cover of the book. And then when I was working with the press about, you know, the external features of the book, I thought, you know, that's the good image. As you were saying, we have in this image is a woodcut with a woman in a kind of melancholic pose, meditating on death. There's a skeleton, basically, there's a corpse. All this happens in a sort of closeted space, which could be a room, a bedroom. It's not very clear what kind of space is that, but it's a very sort of intimate space, if you will. But at the very same time, it reads as a theatrical space, because it's a very precise perspectival space, and you can imagine it really as a locus, right? I think this image captures the main threads I have been dealing with in this project: the meditative spiritual dimension of the materials I was working with, the spatial dimension of the meditation process, and the theatrical metaphor, which constantly comes up throughout the works I've been working on. This particular woodcut comes from the Discorsi Morali by Glissenti, which is a 5-day dialogue on the art of dying well, and Ars Moriendi, as we said earlier, which is an itinerant dialogue where the two protagonists of the dialogue, a philosopher and a courtier, walk throughout the space of Venice. And, you know, this is a 5-day dialogue which is presented in the preface by the author as a kind of a theatrical representation. He is very explicit in saying that these 5 days function like the 5 acts of a play. And they are really conducive to allowing the reader of the text to meditate on things, particularly spiritual things, including death. And so, going back to the image, that particular woodcut, which comes up in the book alongside many more woodcuts, I thought it was particularly striking and extremely able to summarize the main issues at stake here. I should also add that this particular book is extremely rich in images. It's one of the most interesting illustrated books published in Venice at the very end of the 16th century, 1596. And the woodcuts are clearly part of the text. So once again, we go back to the question of combining the word with the visual, something which Glissenti was clearly very invested into.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And just as you were speaking too, I couldn't help but review the woodcut when you described it as a theater and this locus where things happen, and also the kind of framing on either side of the image when readers are going Google Professor Ruffini's book here, we'll see these kind of curtains that curtains almost made out of skeletons. And this brings us back to what you describe as the moral dissections that we read in the morality plays, where man is up against things that were interior that are now made exterior, and the dissecting of different parts of man's spirit then here in the image get dissected as man's kind of physical construction, framing this moment of reflection on death itself. And so I was happy to hear or to note that the female figure, of course, functions as the portal, the window into the book. And I want to know, you know, how does she relate to the kinds of female orphans who really engage then with his spiritual plays? And when we think about women's performance in this period, obviously there's so many different types of group that we could gravitate to, whether the actresses that are debated about in the Discorsi Morali, or the kind of birth of the professional actress in this period, but then also, you know, convent drama is so widespread, and almost that's sort of where we go when we think about, well, what's drama in other types of maybe more sacred spaces, kind of closed spaces that are interested in the trajectories of the spirit. We seem to know so much more about that than we do about the morality plays as they were played out in Venice. And so can you tell us about just what's your sense about why we know so much more about convent plays, and then what would the investment, let's say, of these female orphans be in joining together with their fellow girls and experiencing these plays as a group?
So this really raises a very important question, which is particularly relevant for the context of Venice, right? Because as you were saying, in this particular moment in the history of European drama and particularly Italian theater, we have the emergence of professional theater with the actresses, you know, the sort of Isabella Andreini kind of type. But we also have the traditional convent drama, which of course has been extremely important to me in terms of looking at previous scholarship in cognate fields. Particularly the work of Elissa Weaver has been extremely crucial to sort of allowing me to set the field for my own work on the spiritual plays of the ospedali. Now, what is peculiar about the case I've been working on, and which is, you know, partly different from what happens with convent theater, is that the plays which Glisenti composed, they were really meant to be performed within the ospedali of Venice by the orphan girls, as you were saying, the so-called putte, who lived there, or at least who got their education there. One of the specific features of the ospedali, the hospitals in Venice, is that they functioned also as orphanages. And, you know, people who don't work on these kind of topics might sort of forget about this particular dimension. And as orphanages, they would be running all sorts of activities, including pedagogical activities. And Glisenti, who was a doctor in the Venetian ospedali, was clearly also interested in joining the pedagogical scope of the institutions. And so he wrote these plays for the female orphans, and particularly for that moment in the year, which coincided with Carnival, which again brings us back to the question of tensions and conflicts in Baroque culture, particularly in Venice at the time. So we can imagine a situation where outside in the streets, Carnival is kind of, you know, in full bloom, and the ospedali are proposing within the walls of the ospedali themselves a different kind of drama, an alternative to the secular drama out there, which is spiritual, which is pedagogical, and which is meant to train those orphan girls as good Christians. So we are, of course, within the borders of radical orthodoxy, if you will, in terms of religious thinking and religious doctrine. But at the same time, these plays were meant to be offered to an audience of people who were allowed into the hospitals and who would be, giving gifts to the hospital. They weren't paying tickets, of course, but they were, you know, donating to the hospitals. And we do know through a series of documents that process was particularly successful. So this is the kind of context where we might want to situate the particular commitment of someone like Glisenti to this dramatic theatrical endeavor. And the orphan girls do play a crucial role, because it's through their bodies and through their voices which these plays were first staged. Then there's a second part of the story, which is what happens to the plays once they get printed. And that brings us to the question of accessing drama through reading, meditative reading, which of course at that point goes beyond the boundaries of the hospital. And just to close on the comparison with convent drama, quite clearly there are similarities, because we are talking about homosocial dimensions in terms of structures. We have a body of actors, actresses, who is entirely female in this case. And we have a very strong religious/spiritual component. Yet the situation of the orphan girls was not exactly the same as that of the nuns in convents for obvious reasons. So there are some similarities, but also some social differences which are important to consider. In a way, the fate of these two different bodies of people were different because on the one hand, nuns were supposed to spend the rest of their lives in the convent, whereas most of the orphan girls were meant to end up at some point in the real world out there. And so one of the functions of these plays was to prepare them to be good Christians out there in the secular world.
That's wonderful. It just is so tantalizing to wish that we were back in then 1600 Venice at one of these ospedali, paying or gifting something to be able to just catch this experience. And every time that we've said the word pedagogy, you know, I can't help but ask, having written a book now on pedagogy and having studied an instructor who's interested not only, as you're saying, in the girls' experience at the orphanage where they would have their learning, but then, you know, what that means for that experience at that time, and then how that acts as training for life later on, and then also how that acts or how that can be transformed into a book for meditative reading that could reach other audiences later down the road. All of that investment in pedagogy, it makes me want to ask a question about the sort of other side of things that we do in the academic life. We engage so much with students, and we're invested in their lives as they're with us in semesters studying these texts, and curious about how it might impact them later on in life. You know, one of these things that we'll say is, you know, you'll find yourself 10 years from now, something from this class might come back to you, and you might say, aha, that's why Odysseus decided to travel, right? And those moments are really special, and they do connect with students. So how has writing this book made you think about your role inside the classroom, and maybe even your role in talking with students about books, or how you see the pedagogical value of books? Have there been moments, you know, maybe post-production, knowing how busy production can be, in these post-production reflections, have there been kind of halo moments where you've kind of thought about this?
Yes, indeed. Actually, many moments of that kind. And I can maybe tackle this question in a very kind of practical way, in the sense that, of course, writing about, you know, these orphan girls who were, in a way, students within their kind of, you know, pedagogical context, and writing about them as someone who's not just a researcher, but also a professor, an instructor, I found myself several times thinking about, you know, what's the difference between our classroom and what was happening, say, in Venice in 1606 in the Ospedale degli Incurabili? The answer there is that, of course, you know, we have a huge amount of differences. But one particular thing which came out of my writing the book in terms of thinking about pedagogy is, again, the question of how powerful the performative discourse can be. Of course, you know, the easiest way to rethink about this in the context of our classrooms today would be, you know, let's have the students play with these texts or texts of this kind in a properly dramatic, theatrical way. And that's a possibility which, of course, comes up all the time whenever we work with drama. And, of course, I happen to be teaching drama-related stuff quite often. So this kind of thing comes up all the time. Here at NYU, I have many students who take my classes, and they come from Tisch, and many of them do drama, and several of them come up with the idea of doing performances in class. And that's a great addition to what I normally do. But another way to think about pedagogy in the context of my writing this particular book has really to do with what you were saying, that is books. No, what is the relevance of books as material objects in today's classroom? In classrooms where we don't see many books at this point, because most of our students, you know, they seldom buy books. They get ebooks if needed. They get PDFs of things to read. But I still like to bring books in my classroom, and I can possibly answer this question with one practical example. I'm preparing for my teaching this coming semester. I'm going to teach a first year seminar on poetry. And one of the assignments of the semester will be a thorough close reading of Virginia Woolf's Orlando. I got the most recent Penguin edition of Orlando because I needed to find, you know, an easily available, accessible edition for the students. And I just found out that in this particular recent edition, they have taken away all the images which are in the original text. I mean, as many of you know, Orlando by Virginia Woolf has a set of a few images, mostly portraits of Orlando during her or his transformations across the ages. And those images are particularly important, right? They are part of the text. Now, taking those images out of the text means doing, you know, means altering dramatically what the text is about. And so I think I will use, for instance, this specific example to show the students how the relationship between images and words is much more than just decorative. In several important cases, images are indeed part of the text, and teaching them, that is the students, how to navigate this combination of words and images is really one of the things which I find more productive, no matter what the text is really about. So I hope that the practical example sort of answers the question better than, you know, sort of more general thoughts.
No, I mean, they're experiences, right? And that's so fundamental to what the book is about. It's about the actual experience of implementing this in real time. And I can contribute with a sort of counterexample or a complementary example. I have just started at Duke a course, Race and Power in the Renaissance World, which is also a first year seminar. And in today's class, we were interested in book covers to books about the Renaissance. And what do you think you would get out of this book given this image? What do you think you get out of this book, you know, given this image? And then you look at titles, right? And all the things that make books what they are, especially when we study this historical period, are the things then that determine how students are introduced to these materials so often for the very first time. So that's a little bit of a tragedy on Penguin's part because of, you know, with Woolf's great text. So, but it's useful then for students to know about that, right? So the things they inherit now are not the things that have always been. The last kind of big question brings us to the conclusion of the book and this just fascinating and really extraordinary experiment that Luca Ronconi, the director, who I know for his very experimental work with Ludovico Ariosto's Orlando Furioso. He did this experiment in 1987, as you write, with his students at Rome's Accademia Nazionale d'Arte Drammatica, and they staged a double bill of Baroque plays, so sort of, you know, the Baroque on steroids that evening, where one play was by Giovan Battista Andrini, you mentioned Isabella Andrini, so this is the great diva's son, and then the other play is one of the examples by Glisanti. And when you're writing about Ronconi, you bring out the director's concern precisely for his students' education and kind of his frustration as a director in wanting to see their own concern about their role as humans in the life. And, you know, kind of how do you go about being an actor and a student and a citizen in the universe and what Ronconi thought about that. So it's a beautiful way, I thought, to wrap up the long life of Glisanti's text and how he can return to us today. So the first part of this question is how did you come across that, this double bill? And the second one is, what would you, could you imagine Glisanti's Morali play, one of them being put on today? Could you imagine, you know, a kind of another version of this 1987 experiment as either a double bill or just, you know, Glisanti headlining on his own? What your thoughts are? Are we ready for a Glisanti comeback?
Right. Well, I think we definitely are. And, you know, I think that both sides of the questions are extremely interesting. I will begin from the Ronconi part of it. I think I sort of bumped into that particular example of sort of unearthing the Glisanti play at the Accademia Nazionale di Arte Drammatica randomly. And, you know, I mean, you know, we always tell our students that we have to search for information in rigorous ways. And of course, I'm a big fan of doing things in rigorous ways. But, you know, Google is always, you know, a goldmine of information, which of course then need to be double checked, even triple checked. But I think I really bumped into these information on Glisenti's play La Morte Innamorata, Death in Love, being performed in Rome, really by chance, kind of just doing some word search online. And then, of course, I began to look into that particular example a little more. And that's when I found that the play was given sort of side by side with Giovan Battista Andreini, Amor nello Specchio. So I thought this is a fantastic example of how, you know, sort of two-faced the Baroque is, because La Morte Innamorata is a play about spiritual meditation, is a play about, it's basically a sacred drama on the, you know, sort of constant fight between soul and body, between death and spiritual death and damnation, and all this kind of, you know, very spiritually religious loaded tropes. And then on the other side, Amor nello Specchio is the other face of the Baroque, right? I mean, it's all about sensual love. Of course, it's done in a very sophisticated and complex ways. It's a very interesting play per se, but very different from Glisenti's. So I think I play with the idea of these two facets of the Baroque in the conclusion of the book, really to show how, even if very different from one another, these experiences do clash and do produce meaning. And, you know, my understanding is that Ronconi at the time did think the same. And what is interesting there is that he thought about these two plays as a possible way for the young actors and actresses to really sort of train themselves as actors, as performers, with texts that do not deal with characters in the more traditional sense, more modern sense, which we normally give to the term character, right? So I think going back to the early modernity phase of theater to rethink what drama and theater more broadly is about. Now, are we ready to repeat that kind of experiment today? I would say that if we do it in the right way, yes, these are long plays, which means that they need to be shortened a bit. They also need to be translated in case we want to do them with, let's say, Anglophone students. But there's much potential in there. There are very funny moments in them. There are moments where, you know, you have big group scenes, monologues, there's everything in there. And you can imagine, I always like to think about these dramas made, produced in the ospedali, a little bit like, you know, the high school musicals in our own time, when you need to find a little role for all students, right? If you look at the dramas by Glisenti, that's exactly the case. You have even 30, 35 characters altogether, and each of them have small parts. So you can, I think, really sort of see that kind of combination of pedagogy and performance. So the answer, the brief answer is yes. As long as we find, of course, the right way to repackage these complex works into a more palatable a source for both modern performers and modern audiences.
Sure, sure. I mean, it sounds like there's a great potential, not least with all those characters and the opportunities then to reveal all of the ways that Glisenti imagined the moral dissection of man and all of our layers and complexities, that it's not, you know, that we just have interior demons or the psyche or passion or free will, right? But all of the layers and you include throughout the book, the character lists, and they're quite long. Just spending time sort of just meditating on those is its own pedagogical invitation, right, to reflect on ourselves.
And, you know, if I can add just kind of a footnote, one particular aspect which I think would be extremely interesting to explore in modern performances is that, as I said, these plays, which of course feature both male and female characters, even if they're all allegorical personifications, they were meant to be performed by an all-female cast of actors, right? So I think the question of gender confusion, for instance, comes up all the time. So you see another element of tension there, because on the one hand, these plays are extremely orthodox, extremely canonical in terms of Christian doctrine. And yet, when you bring them on stage, they inevitably bring up questions of tension and confusion, which, for instance, deal with the question of who's performing which role and what kind of gender labels can be attributed to these specific roles. So that's another aspect which I think might make this kind of materials palatable for our current rethinking of categories such as those of gender as performance and gender in performance.
Definitely. I mean, who doesn't love transgressive orthodoxy? I mean, that I love the opportunity that all of that gives us. So, Eugen, if we could just round out this wonderful conversation, it's just been so marvelous. Asking you what comes next. I can never get enough of your research, of hearing what goes on in your mind. And so, what are you cooking up with your current research? What is next on the horizon for you?
Right. Let's say that the biggest project I'm working on, I'm trying to wrap things up with another book, which deals with the reception of the trope of the lament in Baroque poetry and music, really revolving around the figure of Ariadne, abandoned by Theseus. And the idea is to sort of cherry pick a few examples, beginning, of course, with the post Monteverdi kind of rediscovery of Ariadne in the 17th century, and think about what happens when the lament is given a bunch of new shapes through performance. So I'm really trying to continue my own reflection on performance and the performative as a space conducive to experimentation across poetry and music in this case, and the broader reflection, which I've been working on for a few years now on questions of reception. So that would be kind of combining really my performative hat with the reception hat. And let's see where things will go with that.
That sounds great. Well, I can't wait for developments on that front. And of course, for the exciting number of readers that are now going to flock to Staging the Soul, Allegorical Drama as Spiritual Practice in Baroque Italy. Eugenia, thank you so much. And it's been just such a pleasure chatting with you about your book. Congratulations again.
Thank you, Kate. My pleasure. Thanks very much.